Okay. All right. I'd like to introduce Gary Hebert. Gary is the chief technology officer of that corporation, and he's very chief and very technical. He's developed some very beautiful integrated circuits over the years. It's made that a very successful company. One of the few of the great analog companies still left, yes. So I'll let Gary proceed to his discussion about his latest successful endeavor.
Thank you.
Gary, let's talk on.
And self-introduction, and I think you have to use the keys. He's wired.
Okay, so self-introduction. Well, I guess to what Renee said, I'll add, I'm a drummer. I'm actually hightailing it out of here tomorrow morning because I have a gig Friday night to get to. And in my spare electronics time, I do some tube guitar act work, which is much more immediate gratification than working on ICs, where things take a long time to actually get something that you can.
Gary, listen, I think your mic is muted.
Yeah.
Where's the button?
Carefully.
There we go. Ah. Okay. So hopefully you heard what I said earlier. I don't have to repeat that. Thank you all. Quite a large crowd here. So tonight I hope to give you a little bit of a peek into how the sausage is made with respect to the design of an IC. I guess I was inspired by the dinner you guys treated me to tonight. So this device that I'm going to talk about is the latest addition to our line of digital mic preamp gain controller ICs. I'll get into a little bit of what exactly that is. So I'll start with telling you a little bit about that corporation for those of you who don't know us. Then I'll just start out explaining what we mean when we talk about pro mic preamplifiers. I think all of you, given what I heard earlier, are probably familiar, but we'll go through that just to start. I'll explain what a digital mic preamp gain controller is and look at some of the products that we've already had on the market. The initial products were aimed primarily at the very high performance end of the market and were often deemed a little too costly for some high volume applications that we would love to get into. So in contrast to perhaps many AES presentations, the focus tonight isn't on our latest and greatest state-of-the-art chip. It's on the choices that we had to make to bring this product to a broader marketplace, what we had to do to reduce cost, the performance trade-offs that we had to make to do that. And I'll give you a little overview of what the performance of the resulting chip is, and we'll wrap things up and take questions. So for that corporation, we're 27 years old now. We've been in business since 1989. It's kind of amazing to me. We, as it says here, came from a company called DBX, a little shared history with Renee, and initially sold ICs and modules that DBX was manufacturing. And also when we started out, we were building complete pro audio products that we designed and built for other companies. A little ways into it, after we were founded, we purchased the DBX licensing business, which at that time was primarily licensing noise reduction systems to the television industry. In the late 90s, we decided to focus the hardware efforts entirely on the IC side of things as opposed to building complete products. And in 99, we purchased a small wafer fab in Milpitas, California. On the licensing side, these days, the business is still aimed at television set manufacturing, but we license DSP code for audio enhancement. So, pro mic preamps have to be able to accept pretty much anything that's got an XLR on the end, which means it's got to have a balanced input. So, when you, well, at least at the low output level of that, you've got to have very low noise in the preamp. We would like to think it's, on the order of or less than the thermal noise of the 150 ohm source, which is kind of the model for the noise of a microphone. We did a survey some time ago and actually only found one microphone that really had self-noise that was on the order of 150 ohms, but there's quite a few that are not too far off. You need a wide range of gain because microphones have a wide span of sensitivities. That same study we did, we saw at least a 37 dB range in sensitivity, and then, of course, sound pressure levels vary a lot with what you're doing with it, from sticking it in a kick drum to miking a string quartet. And for signal level handling, the highest output condenser that we found could put out about 16 dBU. That we had one exception, a microphone that could put out a bit more than that, which ironically was a ribbon that had a built-in phantom-powered preamp, and at least the data sheet claimed that it would put out plus 19 at 150 dB SPL.
On that thermal noise spec, how does the 150 ohms relate to noise?
Well, it's 100 minus 138, or 30.8 dBU in the audio band.
So
it's about 1.58 nanovolts per root hertz, if that is more relatable for you.
Would more noise be a higher ohm number or a smaller ohm?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely. The thermal noise in a resistor increases with the square root of the resistance. So the way I always remember it is a 1K ohm resistor is about 4 nanovolts per root hertz, and you can go anywhere you need to from there.
Okay, I've seen the second line as a noise spec, but not the 150 ohm thing. Okay, obviously.
Good question.
Gary, would you prefer not to mention those particular microphones?
I probably have the spreadsheet here somewhere. How about we do that at the break?
Sure.
I believe the high output ribbon was an Audio Technica, I think. And I don't remember what the next one down in terms of output level was. And the least sensitive mic was actually a Dynamic that was just made for hanging in front of guitar cabinets. So it was just made to just take lots of level. Okay, so you know we're making these ICs to provide digital control over pro mic preamps. You know, these days a digital audio system is, you know, the mic preamp is signal processing interface for an A to D converter. And adding digital control gain brings that piece of the system in line with most everything else. So rather than having software control over everything and then have this row of knobs for the mic trims, you know, it's now uniform. And that obviously brings the opportunity for some enhanced automation features. Obviously, the setup and recall stuff is the most obvious thing. But you can imagine things like automatic gain reduction in response to clipping and kind of semi-automated setup depending on, okay, well, I know I'm going to mic a kick drum. Give me the standard setup for this. Now, those sorts of automation features are probably not needed or maybe even desired by pros. But they're often unavailable to the semi-pro or the casual user, which is where they might do the most good. So part of the idea here was to try and bring this down to a price level where we could get to those lower-priced products.
Question?
Yeah.
What's the gain resolution you can handle?
Well, I'll be getting into that. So let's start out with what we consider a typical mic preamp front end, at least for our mic pre ICs. This isn't the only way to do things, but it'll serve as an illustration. So this is a differential amplifier. Gain equation is here, as you can see. That is the differential gain. You know, just as an aside, this configuration has a common mode gain of unity, so it's usually followed by something that can strip that common mode signal off, be it the A to D converter itself, or sometimes for more demanding applications, you need something else that can handle a wider range of common mode signals that can strip that off. The obvious stuff, some blocking capacitors at the input. To make that low noise spec that we talked about earlier, this RG resistor here needs to be quite low. Typically at high gains, this is a few tens of ohms, or sometimes even less, because remember the noise of that feedback network that has thermal noise, the amplifiers themselves have noise. So in order to make the total noise low enough, that's got to be a pretty low resistor. And that has some implications on what you do when you try and automate this.
There's
a footer there. It's not that important, but sure, why not?
Well, you want the commercial.
Exactly. Got to get the marketing in there. One last note about this setup is that the difference in input offset voltage between these two op amps, as shown here, would get multiplied by that differential gain. And that's a problem if you're going to have 60 dB of gain. You start really eating into your headroom. So you got to deal with that one way or another. And we do that in these parts. We'll get into a little bit more detail on that in a minute. So what's this programmable gain controller thing? It's a digitally controlled feedback network. And in our parts, the digital control is provided via a three-wire serial interface, often known as a spy port. So what have we said? Well, the RG is going to get very small at high gains. That implies that the switches, the electronic switches that you're going to use to handle that, have to be low on resistance. That has implications on die area and cost. And of course, at high gains, the ratio of RF to RG is going to be very large. And that has implications on cost of the IC. So our first products were aimed at the high-performance end of the market. The first one out was a 1 dB per step resolution, to your question. Very low distortion performance, that was a key, one of the things we were really driving at. The second part was 3 dB per step. We learned a little bit and made it go all the way down to 0 dB. Still very good distortion performance, and you know, still pretty high-end. Both of these parts have very high accuracy in the gain steps, and they both include a DC servo to deal with that offset issue that I mentioned earlier. So the topology that we used on these parts uses a combination of a tapped string of resistors, which you see kind of at the ring around the left side, and these array of paralleling resistors for the RF feedback, or at least a portion of the RF. And it might not be immediately obvious, but those two approaches, the tapped pairs of resistors and the parallel pairs of resistors, create two independent multiplicative factors in the gain equation. So now we can reuse the dB steps created by one set and the dB steps created by the other step independently, which reduces the number of switches we need. We'll leave the solution of that one to the reader. Okay, so for both of these parts, the tap string shown in red here is used to create the large steps. It's 8 dB per step in the 5171 and 9 dB per step in the 5173. And one of the things to note is that in this case, the switches being connected to the inverting inputs of the amplifiers have no signal current through them. So they don't affect THD. They also don't affect the gain accuracy. That's entirely dependent on the resistor ratios. They do, however, contribute their own thermal noise because they have finite on resistance. And one of the themes you'll hear in this talk over and over again is low on resistance costs money. Switches have to be big to have low on resistance. So that thermal contribution, you know, causes you to have to use expensive large switches. Just to reiterate what I said earlier, the minimum RG in that part, that red resistor right there, is 5.6 ohms in the 5171. One of the reasons we go as low as we do is because we have to make the noise contribution of that low enough to make up for the fact that we have additional noise sources coming from those switches. That resistor is a very wide, short rectangle of polysilicon. Integrated resistors have a parameter that we call sheet resistance, and its units are ohms per square. So when you have this uniformly thick resistive material, you can characterize the resistance by the length and width. And if you take a single square, you have but in this case, 610 ohms per square for this process. You can make that square any size you want. It's still 610 ohms. And if you want to make a bigger valued resistor, you start putting those in series or stretching it to make it longer. If you want to make it lower, you put them in parallel or effectively just make it wider. And that the fact that there's a large aspect ratio here also plays into die area, and we'll get into that into a little bit more detail later.
When you say square, is that is the physical size of that square, is that determined by the process, like the resolution of the process?
The physical size at its minimum is determined by design rules in the process, that there are certain dimensions you can't go below and reliably make the thing.
Okay.
Why you might make it bigger depends on things like how repeatedly you want to match that or ratio it to other resistors, how much you want to heat and cool with signal, which causes distortion. So, you know, you'd love to make everything as small as possible. In analog, you often can't do that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So the paralleling resistors are used for the small steps on these two parts. So they implement the 1 dB steps in the 5171 and the 3 dB steps in the 5173. So these resistors are, in general, fairly large valued, which helps because then the switches that are in series with them don't need to be quite so low resistance. But they're now distortion contributors. We help that situation by successively paralleling them. So as you go down in gain in parallel to lower values, we're successively adding resistors in parallel so they share that signal current. And finally, we use a dynamic gate drive to these MOSFET switches so that we try and maintain as close to constant on resistance as we can. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. The highest value of the resistors in the 5171 part is 47K ohms. So you can see it is a substantially higher resistor than the 5.6 ohms. That's the minimum RG resistor. And having a very wide ratio of resistors that you need to create, but that are still accurately, that ratio is still maintained accurately over production processes is one of the things that makes you have to use larger area. If you make things bigger, they're less sensitive to little variations in the edges and how things are diffused and etched. So that resistor is obviously very narrow and long. So as I mentioned earlier, many customers have deemed these to be too expensive for many applications, particularly at the entry level where we'd like some of those automation features. So I'm going to talk a little bit next about what makes them expensive and what we had to do to come up with a less costly part. So, resistors, bigger is better. As I said, ratio accuracy increases directly with resistor area. On the distortion side, for these paralleling resistors, the distortion due to self-heating is proportional to this equation here, which is somewhat empirically derived from measurements that we did, but where SG here is the sensitivity of the gain to the particular resistor you're addressing. The IRMS is the signal current squared, so this is a power thing. We're heating and cooling the resistor, so you'd think it would be proportional to the square of the current. And then that bottom W is the width. So if you want to minimize distortion, you have to make the resistor wide. And if you want to keep the same value, you've got to make it that many times as long as well. It just gets bigger. So high accuracy in the gain ratio, especially over this very large gain range, costs money. Same thing with switches. Bigger is better. R-on is inversely proportional to device width. Making low R-on minimizes noise from the tap string, minimizes distortion from the paralleling resistors, the switches associated with the paralleling resistors. And high voltage capability, we said, you know, we wanted to make these parts run off plus or minus 17 volt rails so that you could use them with line level inputs, except plus 26 dBu in. That costs money. The area of the switch goes roughly with the square of the operating voltage. So that's a very big driver of cost. So what did we do? Well, the easy stuff, okay, we were going to stick with three dB per step rather than 1 dB per step. Despite initial market input where everybody said they wanted 1 dB per step, they were okay with 3 dB per step for a mic trim. We were going to make this a dual channel part. It saves some of the package costs because some of the redundant pins that you would have on two packages are now, you only have to put in there once. And it saves a little bit in the SPI interface, which is not a huge piece of the chip, though as we get to lower and lower cost parts and smaller parts, it becomes a bigger piece. We got rid of the servo, which reduces the die area directly, took out some power, but now you're back to this large external capacitor that people very much don't like. It's big, it's generally electrolytic, it's in series with the feedback network. It's a really good antenna, effectively right at the inputs to your mic pre. So it requires care, but it is definitely the lower cost way to go. And servos have their own issues. I wrote a paper about that a couple of years ago. If you want to change gain very quickly, you've got to kind of wait for the servo to react or do something to deal with the fact that it adjusts itself every time you change gain. The next thing we did was to change the topology. We no longer are varying RF and RG simultaneously. We switched to an approach of just doing RG and put the switches in series, so they are now part of RG, the on resistance of the switch. That has some implications. The first thing is, of course, now they become part of the distortion equation. They contribute noise, but they're not contributing any additional noise. You're going to reduce the resistors to make the value you want, including the on resistance. So there's no additional thermal noise contribution. So that's actually a bit of an advantage compared to the tap string, where those switches are contributing additional thermal noise. What else can I say about this? Well, we decided to stay with the dynamic gate drive for these to reduce the distortion. That is a rather elaborate gate driver per switch, but we were able to stick that in there to help maintain low distortion. The other piece that this implies is the gain accuracy is now affected by switch on resistance, which doesn't track with sheet resistance of the polysilicon resistors. So, all of these resistors are made out of the same material, they're on the same die, they track each other, so although we have to live with the fact that the absolute resistance goes up and down by 20%, the gain doesn't change. Well, that doesn't track with the on resistance of MOSFET switches. So, particularly at high gains, the switches become a factor in the gain accuracy, so you'll get lot-to-lot variation in what gain you actually get when you say, I want 41 dB or whatever. I mentioned that we stuck with the dynamic gate drive. The other thing we did was we reduced the maximum available gain. That saved area in a couple of ways. It reduced the number of switches we needed a little bit. It also made the minimum RG somewhat larger. I guess the last point I'd make about the dynamic gate drive in this case is for differential signals, it doesn't have much to do. The signal swing at the center of the RGs for a purely differential signal is quite small, so it's kind of loafing most of the time. If you drive it with a single-ended signal, then things change. So how can we get away with reducing this gain? Everybody, if you've been doing this a long time, you think, well, mic preamps have at least 60 dB of gain. What's the deal? Well, as I said, these things are front ends to analog to digital converters. So this graph is a plot of the dynamic range at the input to both 114 dB A/D and 120 dB A/D with an absolutely noiseless perfect preamp and 150 ohm resistor at the input. Initially, along the left-hand side of the curve, the dynamic range is entirely determined by the A/D converter dynamic range, and you get what the spec sheet those guys gave you, hopefully, if you've laid it out right. But as you increase the gain, eventually, when you get above about 30 dB or so, the noise of that 150 ohm resistor multiplied by the gain is way above the noise floor of the converter. there's no further advantage in dynamic range at all going to higher gains. It's the dynamic range is going down as you down with the gain. So there's no disadvantage if you want to add more gain and get your signals up closer to full scale to putting it after the converter. I mean, and you're not getting any advantage there in dynamic range. You're just, it's looking good to you because you've got your signals up close to the full scale. But the noise floor has come up just as much. The dynamic range is unchanged. So that's how we said, well, yeah, 51 dB. Typically for these things, if you're running them up high supply voltages, you've got after that 51 dB, some 16 dB of attenuation or so, which puts you right in the region 35 or so where, you know, the noise floor of, and this is just the thermal noise of an ideal 150 ohm source. Your microphone's probably noisier than that, and the preamp's adding noise too, so this actually starts a bit earlier. So then you saw that paralleling of RG resistors. How did we actually implement that? The initial impulse for on our part was to have a set of binarily weighted resistors. Actually, since RG lives in the denominator of the gain equation, it's really better to think of it as binarily weighted conductances. And if you just, for instance, pin the 3 dB gain point to be correct, 0 dB is a degenerate case, there's no RG at all, and then use binarily weighted resistors from there, you come up with the red curve. And at low gains, where you have relatively few resistors to choose from, you can't get very close in choosing these 3 dB steps. But if you bend a couple of those to try and optimize at low gains, at high gains, you've got lots of choices of paralleling resistors. You can get pretty damn close. So we were able to find combinations where the nominal gain, in any case, fits within this plus or minus 0.2 dB window.
What does bending mean?
Changing the values so that they're a little bit not binary.
Calculated imperfection?
Calculated empirically imperfection.
Monte Carloing kind of thing? Or?
No, it's playing with a spreadsheet and saying, oh, okay, well, we need to bend this one this way and this one this way.
Okay, so cheating.
Cheating, yeah, well, that works.
So Gary, the...
It's not cheating, it's actually a good optimization.
So binary R's would just be a doubling. Is that
yeah, you, in other words, in the red curve, we started, I think the nominal 3 dB RG is something like 24 point something K, and then there would be a 12 and a 6, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So the bent is, instead of just doubling or halving, you're kind of...
A little off.
Yeah.
Those
numbers are
I mean, those are effectively kind of the LSBs, and we made them a little bit, as if you had a converter where they were a little off, but... When you get to high gains, they have very little influence on what's going on.
Yeah.
Hi.
For those of us who aren't IC builders like Steve and electrical engineers, can you just kind of very quickly, 30 seconds, tell us what RG and all the other abbreviations are?
Okay. So RG refers to the initial preamp schematic that I showed with the two op amps, and I had two resistors coming from the output back to the inverting inputs. Those were the RFs. And the one between the inverting inputs is RG in this case. It's shorthand that we use, and it's been consistent through the presentation, that RG is that shunt resistor, and RF are the ones coming from the output.
And G stands for gain.
Yeah, and F stands for feedback.
So it's feedback resistors and the gain setting resistors.
For lack of better terms. Sure.
In a typical analog microwave, the knob you're turning is RG.
Yes, in the analog implementation, that would be a pot set up as a variable resistor.
Right. Question, Gary.
Yeah?
That capacitor in the RG network, is that fixed?
Is it fixed?
Yeah.
Yes, that's external.
Okay, so it's in a series of the resistor network.
That gets pretty small.
So that's going to present itself as a high-pass filter.
Yes, signal. That's that where the corner is gain-dependent.
Okay, so what's that going to do to the cutoff frequency when you're switching in the 3 dB steps in the gain network?
Well, typically it's chosen to give you adequate low frequency response at the highest gain, and that moves down as the gain goes down.
Okay.
And that is as it has always been when you had the little pot in there as well.
Yeah, is that still below what we could hear anyway? So
if you use a big enough capacitor.
No,
if you're deaf appropriate.
Well, that's to me.
I mean, that was one of the additional benefits of going to a somewhat higher, lower maximum gain, is that that minimum RG got larger, so the capacitor we had to recommend there is not quite so huge.
What do you consider a huge capacitor?
I can't remember. I think we either recommend 470 microfarad or 1,000 microfarad with this part. I can't remember which it is. So, big. Fortunately, it doesn't see much signal swing, so it can be low voltage.
In the better Maggie preamps, we use 6,800 microfarads to get below 52.
And you would probably use get minimum RG of like 10 ohms or something?
Yeah. Less than that.
Okay, so in using that approach, we were able to get 51 dB and 3 dB steps with just 10 switches. These are nominal curves. The actual RG will vary somewhat lot to lot because, again, switch on resistance doesn't track with sheet resistance of resistors. So the last lever that we had to make the target in the end was to reduce the area of the resistors themselves. And, you know, the big compromise there is distortion due to self-heating of the resistors. They're heating and cooling on every cycle of the signal. Because these are, you know, I mean, some of you who do this stuff these days have probably, if you've come from the through-hole world, have seen this in small surface mount resistors. If you don't get them of adequate power rating, you'll see the distortion generated over there. Well, we have it much worse than that. The TEMCO of the poly resistors in this process is nominally 200 ppm per degree C, which is pretty damn good for poly resistors. But that's still finite, and the resistors will still self-heat and cause distortion. Now, fortunately, that's almost pure third harmonic, so it's hopefully not too objectionable. So where do we end up? With our best preamp, we have an EIN of 128.3 dBU with 150.
Define EIN.
Oh, sorry. Equivalent input noise, which is the noise that results if you take all of the noise sources in the preamp itself and lump them all at the input. It's a typical way to specify amplifier noise. In the case of mic preamps, we typically do it with the additional contribution of the 150 ohm theoretical noise of a microphone source. So if you remember when I started this presentation, there was a number of minus 130.8 dBU. That noise in combination with the preamp has come up to minus 128.3. Whatever the difference between those two is what people would call the noise figure. So it's a couple of dB higher than the theoretical minimum you can do. The gain accuracy spec, we have it fairly tight at the lowest gains and have to open it up, at least from what the fab tells us, to plus or minus 1 dB from 42 to 51. We haven't seen anything near that yet, and I have some curves of what actual production units do, but based on what the process guys say we have to live with, and they won't take the wafers back if we complain, that's the kind of spec we have to have.
That's comparable to what was the others, the A1 and the A3?
The other ones are guaranteed less than a half a dB over the entire range, and they're typically within a quarter.
0.62, right?
One was 60, one was 68 point something. So this is the big distortion versus gain at a constant 24 dBU out at a kilohertz. The highest distortion points there are all where you essentially have one of these RG resistors handling all of the signal current, which is where things get roughest because that's doing all the heating and cooling. The 3 dB case is also one of those, but the resistor is high enough that the signal current is lower. You've got sort of a 24K RG in that case. And of course, 0 dB, again, in the degenerate case, as I mentioned earlier, because there's no RG. And this is the curve at 51 dB, plus 24 dB out. You can see the signature of pure third. With a little bit of second peaking up there from something, probably the preamp, actually. This was taken with one of our preamps. No, it was not just the feedback network by itself.
Excuse me,
sure.
On the previous chart,
yes.
The vertical scale is THD in percent or an absolute value?
THD plus N in percent.
Thanks.
Yeah. This is some production gain data. The blue curve is the one I showed you earlier, which is the theoretical nominal. And the green is an average of some recent production units. So there is some more variation than the nominal, but pretty good. This is looking good. And we, like I said, we haven't seen anything close to what the fab tells us we might have to expect. We did manage to keep many of the additional features that are in the other parts. There's two zero crossing detectors in here so that gain changes occur only on zero crossing, at least if you want that. It's defeatable. Because we were kind of pin limited to get into the package we wanted to put this in, rather than having an external RC to set the timeout for the zero crossing detector, which is a time which we wait, and if a zero crossing does not occur, we force the gain change to happen. We did that with an internal timer counter. For pin reasons, again, we went down to one general purpose logic output per channel. These, like our 5173 part, you can sync them to the zero crossing detector. So if you want to switch your pad also at a zero crossing, you can use the zero crossing detector in the part to do that. While where we did spend a couple of pins is to make independent, in other words, both pins of those RF resistors coming from the output back to the inverting inputs available rather than connecting those internally. And the reason for that is that in many low-cost products, there's a low-cost mic preamp topology that involves a couple of complementary feedback transistor pairs where the RG resistor resides at the emitter, the effective emitter of this complementary pair, which sets the transconductance. The current comes out the effective collector and is forced across these independent RF resistors around a second amplifier. Since that was a fairly common low-cost approach to mic pre's, we made this part usable in that configuration, which is a little different from the one I showed you in the beginning here. So in the end, we reduced the cost by 55% over our 5173 part, per channel, that is. This biggest compromise was THD performance. So far, anyway, people seem to be accepting of that. The noise performance is actually slightly better with our best preamp than even our highest end controller part. And that's about it. I want to thank my colleague back at that corporation, Fred, who reviewed this, and thanks to Renee for bugging Les and inviting me out to speak here. And I guess we were going to take a break now and entertain more questions, but I'll take yours now, Steve.
So this is a dual now?
This is a dual.
What's your crosstalk?
The crosstalk is, we have a spec that's well into like 114 or 15 dB, but frankly, the crosstalk in general is limited by your layout. Within the part, we really haven't been able to measure it. But it's a small part, so you've got to be very careful in the layout.
What's the package and pin number?
The package is a 5x5 QFN with 24 pins, I believe. Bob?
Is it a 5-volt part?
Nope. This is high voltage. Still takes plus or minus 17-volt rails max. One of the things that I should mention, perhaps, is that the gain accuracy does degrade if you run it on fairly low supply voltages because those switches are not enhanced nearly as much. The on resistance is a little higher, so that gives you more gain error. Though we do already have a customer that's running on off like plus or minus 6 because it's a low power application.
Is this an all CMOS part, or do you have some bipolar stuff in this too?
I think the only bipolars, at least that come to mind immediately, are in the reference current generator, but everything else is all CMOS. We do have some good bipolars available in this process, and we are now making two mic pre's in this same process because they do have a really nice bipolar available. In fact, our top-of-the-line mic pre is now done in a bi-CMOS process. Ah, sorry, Rick.
If I can remember. This is a one-chip solution. It's not a separate controller part.
It is a separate controller part. Oh,
okay.
This is still a separate controller part. And we're working on some all-in-one solutions. I can't talk too much about that, but that's coming. But
81 and 83 are all-in-ones, right?
Excuse me?
You call this one a 1580?
This one is the 5263. The 1580 is actually our top-of-the-line preamp.
Okay. No, that's a single package solution, all-in-one?
There's no all-in-one solution from us out yet.
So this controller could be used with any of your preamps?
Any of our preamps and with discrete solutions. I mean, we have a number of customers that... I mean, mic pre's are, you know... Especially at the high end for these previous parts that I talked about, there's a mojo thing there. So people use them with their own preamps. We love to sell them ours, and we do for many cases, but there's also, you know, a number of sort of high end preamp guys that wrap this around their own preamps.
In forming the poly resistors to control your parasitic capacitance, does this process have they tweaked the process any to you know, like make the oxide layer thicker or anything to reduce your parasitic?
Well, these are poly capacitors, and it is on a relatively thick, the bottom plate is on a relatively thick oxide. It is what it is. You get the process is the process.
But you have some, I mean, your company has the process, so you have some control.
Not in this case. These are done on an outside foundry. Our fab is a bipolar fab. We don't really make any CMOS there in California. I mean, there's some things I would love to have from that process in this process, but I don't. You know, our thin film cyclone resistors have typical TEMCOs below 50 ppm per degree C. But, you know, you can't have everything. And when we needed to have CMOS switches and logic, you know, I said the logic part is not a big piece of this, and that's because, you know, the logic is 3.3 volts. For that, we use the native CMOS in the process. It's tiny compared to all the analog stuff. But we don't have that capability in our fab. Go ahead.
So how does this compare in quality and cost to other things that are on the market? And could somebody just take it home and build their own mic preamp out of it easily?
Quality and cost, it's certainly the lowest cost solution for doing this sort of thing out there. And it competes very well in terms of noise to the sort of competitive 3 dB per step part from another company. The biggest place where it probably suffers a bit against that part is probably that this third harmonic distortion thing at some gains. That part also has pretty apparent self-heating cause distortion. There was a second part of that. Can you take it home and build your own? Well, if you're capable of soldering a QFN package to your board, this is a leadless surface mount package.
Yeah, it doesn't take alligator clips. Short a few pins.
Yeah, it's way too small for my old eyes.
5x5 millimeters, but how many pins?
24.
Yeah, so it's 24 pins exposed on your little fingernail size.
You have to be careful. I had to strip the 46 gauge wire to get it. I just did some soldering today on 2x2 QFN. Don't do it.
So, what do they cost?
Go to the website. You're asking the wrong guy.
I was just kind of wondering when you were explaining this. So this is two channels on one chip.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if the hacker in me comes out, if you could like gang those up to get for a single channel and start doing different combinations of resistances.
That's not where I thought you were going. Where I was thinking is, you know, paralleling two preamps and getting more dynamic range. But you're thinking maybe of perhaps of getting more resolution and gain?
Yeah, because I'm assuming you can control the two channels independently.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that may not be the most straightforward way to do it.
That's what's appealing.
Okay. You know, one of the things, I don't know if we've published circuit for this. I think Joe's still getting it together, but you know, you can add a stage after the preamp. You know, typically, as I said, there's this stage that's going to strip off the common mode signal and generally attenuate the signals down to the level you need for your converter. You can add a pair of switches controlled by one of the GPOs and get 1.5 dB steps just by doing this 1.5 dB step on that stage. And you can, it'll be controlled, and you can make it sync with the zero crossings and just write your little software to do 1.5 dB steps.
Chris, I think an app note is coming from you on how to parallel this to get more fine.
That will be happy to publish it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, app note material is always welcome.
Well, you can always hang the resistor in series with your DC blocking capacitor too.
Yep.
Oh, well, that's for protection against phantom power faults.
No, that's not what I'm thinking. No, that your DC blocking capacitor between the two op amps, you could always hang a resistor in there, too.
The one in series with our
the external capacitor.
Yes.
You could always put a resistor in series with it.
To change the gain, yes. Again, yeah. Like our switches, that won't track with the plus or minus 20% absolute value tolerance of the resistors in the chip. Problem.
So there's nothing to stop you from omitting the capacitor and doing your own servo.
Not at all. If you want to do your own servo, you're welcome to.
What's the bandwidth of the servo?
Well, there isn't one in
the ones you made.
Well, the capacitors are external, so you can kind of control that. We do make some recommendations, and you do have to be a bit careful when you wrap a servo around this thing and you have input coupling capacitors because it forms a second order high pass, yeah. And you can get peaking at, you know, a half a hertz, which is, you know, people walking around your studio, that may not be a good idea. So do you folks want to take a break? And then I know somebody had a question about the microphone survey, and I can dig up that spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Oh, the price thing. You guys got
to do it after the break.
Okay. Thank you.